And thank you again to everybody that's read, that's helped us open the meeting. And I want to welcome people that have joined us since we first started, and particular welcome to any visitors to our meeting, and a massive welcome to any newcomers to our meeting in NA tonight. And we hope you hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. So we are a speaker meeting. It falls to me to introduce our speaker tonight, who's Paul. He's come along from my old hometown where I was born. Paul and I have known each other on social media for a year or three, but we've never really kind of connected very much until fairly recently, and that's been a pleasure to do that. So I'm really looking forward to hearing Paul share his story with us. He's going to share with us for 40 or 45 minutes. If you like, Paul, I can give you a 5-minute kind of heads up towards the end. He's going to share about his experience, strength and hope. So Paul, floor is yours, my friend. Please share with us.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
It's good to be clean. It's good to be in a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And I'm grateful to Steve for giving me the opportunity to share on this forum and to try and carry a message to the addict that still suffers. You know, whether that addict be someone who's in their first meeting, or whether it's been coming here for a few days, weeks, months or years, doesn't really matter. You know, we are all addicts who suffer with the disease of addiction. You know, if it just went away just like that, we wouldn't have to keep coming back. You know, I was told to keep coming back, so welcome to any newcomers. I was told to keep coming back, but you know, I like to say to people, just stay. You know, this is where the answer lies for this addict anyway. You know, I'm here to share my experience, strength and hope. I'm for 45 minutes, so you know, I can sort of expand a little bit and go into a little bit more detail about who I am, where I'm from, what it was like, how it ended up, and what I did about it, really. You know, as has just been said, I come from a North England town called Liverpool, notorious for being the home of the Beatles. You know, and it's a classic English working class town, you know, and I had like a really good upbringing myself. You know, how my life panned out in the past like 30 years was certainly not the plan for my parents. You know, my parents were like really hard working people, and they had like extremely strong values and morals, and they possessed a work, an old school work ethic. You know, work hard, save money, better your life. You know, and that was always the plan for me. As I was growing up, I always knew what right and wrong was. But you know, although you can't see me, you know, the 70s was like, it was a really disruptive time to grow up in the north of England, in England in general, really. You know, it was a really hard decade economically. You know, everyone was like working hard and struggling and surviving the best they could. You know, and I used to go to school and I'd see all my friends and their parents and their families going through all sorts of struggles. But because of the work ethic that my parents had and the opportunities that they created for themselves, financial insecurity and financial difficulty didn't seem to be a problem to them. Especially when I was about 10 years old, going into secondary school. You know, I always had, most kids back then, you know, it weren't nothing like the 21st century. You know, 2 weeks holiday in a seaside town like Southport or Blackpool or Brighton, It was like a trip to Las Vegas. That's how difficult the 1970s was. You know, many families had like loads of kids, and it was first up, best dressed. You know, new clothes consisted of hand-me-downs from extended family members or friends of the family who'd grown out of stuff. I didn't experience all that. You know, I had like all the best opportunities. I had the best holidays. People were going to seaside towns for summer holidays. You know, I was flying to Malta and Switzerland and spending like 6 weeks on the Côte d'Azur in France, touring around France with a caravan on the car. This is like in 1980, you know, but I always felt sort of disjointed in my community because, I mean, I'm a guy who's got like, I mean, not so far, there was is Jamaican, and my mother is white, and I was brought up in a family environment where like my mother and her husband were white. Their child, my younger brother, was white. And then you had me and my twin brother who were mixed race. We were led to believe for our own protection because of like social politics and the way society viewed ethnic minorities and white women have an ethnic minority, mixed race kids. You know, we were led to believe that we were adopted, and you know, and that always made me feel like really insecure. And I'd come home from school crying, and the kids would be cruel and start attacking me, and I'd ask my parents questions, and they wouldn't give me the answers, so I'd rebel. You know what I mean? I'd rebel the only way I knew how, and that was with my fists, you know. And lo and behold, from a very early age, because I was under constant scrutiny from my peers, basically other kids, and the only way they could affect me was to sort of attack me for the way that I looked, and it made me feel really insecure, you know. And at some point during my childhood, you know, by the age of 10, I was a really angry kid. I mean, and I didn't sort of like feel sorry for myself. I just didn't believe I deserved some of the grief that I got. You know, my only answer to it was violence. And because of the moral standing that my parents had instilled into me, it weren't long before the guilt caught up to me. You know, that terrible, terrible sense of remorse. Which is that distress and pain in my mind brought about as a result of a guilty conscience, because I used to do and lash out and act out and do dumb shit, and then I'd be trying to like manipulate and lie my way out of it, trying to outrun the guilt, lay the blame at someone else's door. It was inevitable for me, I believe, to pick up drugs, because when I first put a substance in my body, it was alcohol. And I was only about 10 or 11. And it just sort of like lit me up and just made all my fears and my doubts and my insecurities and my anger just dissipate as though it didn't even exist in the first place. And I loved the feeling it gave me. I thought, wow, this is the magic formula. You know, so alcohol was the first thing that got invited to my party. And it weren't too long after relying upon that alcohol to sort of like provide me with like that sense of relief and the ease and comfort that I needed when I was distressed. I found that like it didn't stroke the right buttons, so naturally I found cannabis. And then between the age of 10 to the age of 15, 16 when I left school, I traversed the full spectrum of drugs, right through the lot. Well, the first thing to the party was alcohol. The second thing was weed. Then came the trips and the speed and the mushrooms, and you know, and then came the Class A's. You know, till in the end, it was just like a free for all. I used to take anything at the Half the time I wouldn't even ask what it was. If I believed that it was going to change the way I felt, it was game on. No way. I was quite good in school. I remember leaving school. And the educational standard back then was called O-level. I left school with like 9 O-levels. And I certainly never went into my careers officer and said, okay, miss, I want to be a professional junkie. I want to be a prolific criminal. And I want to live the twilight years of my adult life living on the streets like an animal. Can you make that happen? That was not the plan. I had not 9 O-levels. I was part of like, an army cadet force, so I got into like all that type of stuff. And at the time when I leave school was just when the Falklands broke out, and a couple of my mates 2 years older than me had all like joined the army, and we're going on the Ark Royal and sailing to the Falklands to fight war, and I wanted to go in the army, I wanted to jump out of planes, I wanted to make a difference. And that was the plan, and my backup plan was to go to university because I was quite switched on. Educationally, I was quite good at school, right? Even though I did all dumb stuff and I took all these substances, I had this innate ability to get me schoolwork done and get good results, I remember in 1981 that, I've gone to a party with my twin brother, and we were sitting outside the party, and it was like a row of motorbikes lined up outside the party, and we were just like sitting on the motorbikes having a joint or something like that. And the next thing, we get attacked by these big hairy asses, head covered in head to toe with tattoos and black leather. And they attacked us with all like iron bars and chains around their hands and knuckle dusters. So we just run in the party and got knives out of the kitchen. Went back out and defended ourselves. Anyway, that one poor judgment, that one lapse in my rational decision making was a decision that like sucked me into the criminal justice system. And all my dreams just flitted away. As soon as I got arrested and I got convicted, my chances for the army, gone. My chances for university, gone. I was just sat in prison feeling sorry for myself, thinking, what now? And I just sort of like adapted and made myself fit into the environment, the criminal environment. And I just became more skillful at like finding shortcuts to make money, manipulating people, lying, enforcing myself on others, bullying people, just being an out and out bad person, really. But at the time, I thought I was super cool. And this went on for a long time. This went on for a long time, and by this time, I was hopelessly addicted to heroin and cocaine and. And I know it doesn't really matter what you use, but I like to sort of like, I don't want people to disqualify themselves because what I took and where it took me is not your story. It's not about what I took and where it took me. What I took was simply the vehicle I chose to escape me. And if I'm sitting here in Liverpool in the problem and the solution is in like London, I've got a number of modes of transport available to me to get me from the problem, Liverpool, to London, the solution. I can get a bus, a train, a plane, a taxi, I can cycle, I can get a skateboard. I sort of like look at drugs as being like the same choice for transport to escape yourself. So it doesn't matter what you used, for me. You used what you used because that was your favourite mode of transport to escape yourself. So please don't separate yourself if you didn't use the same substance that I used. I used every substance. I didn't really like. I never had a favourite substance. I just used anything, you know. And so me using sort like really, really took off. I mean, it really took off and went to another level. You know, after I was in jail, you know, I met a lot of people in jail, and you know, and my mind told me that they were the cool kids and I had to do what the cool kids did, you know. And I found myself drawn to all these negative personalities, wanting the respect and adulation that I afforded them. I wanted someone to afford that same adulation towards me. So my mind told me, well, if I do what they do, people will look at me the way I'm looking at them. And it just took me on a merry ride for years. You know, it was just a constant cycle of 30 years. I don't think I was out of prison when I did get out for longer than like 12 months. I was virtually in prison. It was just a constant cycle of like prison, get clean. I'd land in the prison at the reception, and I'd look as though I'd just escaped out of Belton or Auschwitz or somewhere. You know, and 18 months behind the door, going to the gym twice a day, doing pad workouts twice a day, eating three meals a day. You know, I'd get out of the prison and I'd look as though I just fell out of GQ or FHM magazine. You know, I'd go in about 8 stone, I'd get out about 14 stone, ripped, looking like a movie star. And in my mind, in reception, I'd be sitting there, I'd be saying, right, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to speak to him. I'm not going to use this. And I had it all mapped out. No sooner had them gates opened, and half an hour later, I'd be doing the same old thing as what I was doing before I went to jail. I'd be scoring and I'd be using. And then the guilt would catch up with me again. And I'd just have to use. I just couldn't bear the internal trauma that I felt when I did dumb stuff. You know what I mean? You know, the only relief I could get was taking drugs. Drugs were my everything, my absolute everything. I remember walking around constantly stuck in my own thinking, wrapped up in myself all the time, worried about what people were thinking about me. Worries about what I wanted people to think about me. Thinking about what I had to do to make you think what I wanted you to think about me. I was just absolutely a prisoner in my own mind. And I was always plotting and planning and scheming. And I'd have all these great ideas about getting clean. I'd go to services. I'd use. Go to jail. I'd go back to services. I'd do something different. I'd use. I'd get myself put in hospital. I'd do the geographicals and go to other countries. You know, I always thought that my problem was based on external circumstances, and I'd always blame, yeah, well, you know, it's because of this, 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 and this, and it had nothing to do with external circumstances. The problem was me. I was just so wrapped up in myself, I just couldn't see beyond myself. I came into the fellowship in 2011, and I was still in a state where I was like absolutely consumed in my own welfare and what I believed I needed to make me feel okay. And I was overly focused in other people's conduct, in how I thought people had to act when they were around me to keep me feeling okay. And when it didn't go my way, I'd become angry, I'd get disturbed, I'd become uncomfortable in myself, the noise in my head would just become unbearable, and I had no choice but to use. You know, the first few meetings I attended, I was like coming out of my own skin, absolutely paranoid, suspicious, on the back foot, stood at the back of the room, didn't have the confidence to even sit in the middle of the room or even let two addicts sit either side of me. I was at the back of the room, standing up with my back against the wall, near the door, and the voice would be saying, "Just get out of here, Paul. These can't do nothing for you. Just go. You know what the answer is? Just go." And something in me, I don't know what it was, but something in me knew that, like, if I left that meeting and I didn't give this a shot, that I was gonna die. You know, I remember sitting in reception on my last prison sentence, and that's where I hit my bottom. You know what I mean? And I just remember sitting there, and I remember, like, having some sort of out of body experience, and, like, zoned out and just went somewhere, and I don't know where. And I just got this intuitive notion, this voice in my soul just said to me, "It's over, Paul." You know, and something just snapped inside me. And then I sort of, like, focused back into reality, and I heard the prison officer screaming my name, saying the nurse wants to see me. And I went into that nurse and I said, "I can't do this no more. I don't want what you've got to offer. Put me in a cell." You know. And I just got that. I just refused all medication because I weren't really on that much, to be honest. At that time, I was due to go into a treatment facility, but done something dumb 4 days before I went in. I thought, I don't need a methadone detox. You know, I haven't been using enough. You know, and I just done it on my back, and I got clean on that sentence, and I didn't use, and my bed got saved in the facility, and then I went to a treatment facility. You know, and thank God for that treatment facility, because my twin brother carried the message to me. You know, through all the trauma that I've suffered as a child, and through all my early drug use and the consequences that came, you know, one person never left my side and never abandoned me. That was my twin brother. But in 2010, something happened, and he entered the treatment facility, and he completely divorced himself from me. And it was such a frightening experience. It was such a lonely, dark and horrible place to be in. I thought, oh my God. And in a few short months, I've just seen this miraculous transformation in this person happen right in front of my eyes. He was unrecognizable, right? But it was attractive what I was watching, you know? And I knew that I had to do what he did. So I went to the same people that referred him to the facility he went to. Got referred by the same people that referred him, went to the same facility, and the same facility sent me to Narcotics Anonymous. Yeah. You know, my first couple of months was really tough, but I knew there was an answer there, because the lifestyle I come from, when you didn't see people for a long time, it was generally because they'd either overdosed and died, or we were doing, like, a long-term prison sentence, a life sentence. Yeah. And I've walked in my first meeting, and I've seen people that I haven't seen for years who I thought were dead or lifed up, sitting there, laughing, joking, really comfortable in themselves, having a laugh with each other, coming over asking me, "Was he all right?" And I was, like, really on my back foot, dead suspicious. And he just wanted to help me, you know, and he knew for a fact, without me even saying it, and he went, "Listen, we don't want nothing off you, we just want you to get what we've got. We want to see you recover your life, we want to see you mend all these relationships that you thought you'd never repair. We want to see you be able to stand on your own 2 feet, we want to see you live life and enjoy life without using drugs. This is where the magic happens." You know, it was attractive what they were saying, so I stayed, and I got involved. You know, it was suggested to get myself a home group, because the last 15 years of my using was spent living on the streets, homeless in the Appeal Town Centre. So, you know, getting a home group somewhere where I felt safe, with a group of people that, like, had nothing but a sincere concern for my best interests. That was something really special. You know, I didn't want to get clean and be homeless in recovery, because I'd just spent a long time homeless, hopeless, absolutely dying from like that sense of despair that I was waking up to every day. So when I found my first home group, I felt really safe. They became like my extended family, and they taught me a lot of stuff. They taught me how to trust people. They taught me how to interact with people. You know what I mean? They taught me how to be responsible and how to get up and show up and be reliable. You know, they taught me spiritual principles of love and honesty. You know, they taught me how to allow someone to express the way they feel towards me, and not be suspicious of that person. You know, they taught me a lot of stuff, my home group. I think the home group is like, it's the most important, one of the most important facets that we've got in Narcotics Anonymous. You know, I remember my first sponsor said to me, he said, Paul, he said, there's four suggested things. He said, if you've got all four things in place, you can be whole once again. I mean, so I got myself a home group, I got myself a sponsor, I started working the steps. You know what I mean? And I used to attend regular meetings. Yeah. And the magic just started to happen. You know, I remember my sponsor looked at step one with my sponsor, and my sponsor says, he said, all right, Paul, let's just keep this simple. He said, in a nutshell, what's your problem? I said, drugs. And he says to me, you haven't got a problem with drugs. He said, drugs have got the problem with you. So I've looked at him, I thought, how's that? But he said to me, he says, well, our basic text tells us, you know, as an addict, what makes us addicts is our physical reaction to drugs, not what we take or how much we take. You know, when he explained, you know, best way I can explain is that my younger brother's a bank manager for NatWest. He hasn't lived the life I live. You know, we can have a drink at Christmas, have too much, get into trouble, and then say to his missus, well, I'll get that away from me. And his troubles end where he makes that decision. I put something in my body, I stop, and my troubles just start. I remember my younger brother saying to me when I was about 16, oh my God, Paul, there's no need for you. Why do you have to take drugs the way you do? And my response was, Gary, why don't you take drugs the way I do? You know, to me, it seemed the only normal, logical thing for me to do, to deal with life. You know, it made my life so much easier when I was off my nut in the beginning. You know, but the longer I took drugs and the faster it progressed, in the end, I couldn't live with or without the drugs, like our literature tells us. You know, so it went hard for me to sort of grasp the idea of, like, you know, I was powerless over my addiction. You know, my sponsor said to me, said, you know, just look over your shoulder at your past experience. Have you been able to make a decision saying, I'm not touching that no more, and live up to that decision? And I went, no. He said, have you ever asked yourself why that is? You know, and he just nailed me. He said, basically, Paul, he said, you haven't got the power necessary to stop yourself killing yourself. He said, and you haven't got a choice in the matter. It just happens. Am I right? You know, so any sane, normal, rational person, some of the horrendous situations I've put myself in, being in hospital for 2 years with like pulmonary embolisms and heart stuff, and you know, to any sane, rational person, that is like a sufficient enough reason to stop doing the stupid stuff I'm doing. You know, but it didn't stop me. Consequences don't have the power to stop me when I start. When I start, I can't stop. And when I do stop, the necessary power to prevent myself from starting again, regardless of consequences, is not there. You know, my experience showed me that. No, so it didn't take me long to sort of come to believe in the Narcotics Anonymous program. I came to believe when I seen the transformation that I witnessed within my twin brother, and seeing him sort of like recover his life quite quickly. got himself a nice job, got himself a nice partner, on his way to a career, got all the outside shiny stuff. And I thought, wow, if he can do it, I can do it. And I looked around the room and I thought, if these other addicts who I identify with, who've been in the same places that I've been to for the same reasons that I went there, if they can do it, I can do it. You know, and I just kept coming back and I just threw myself in the middle of Narcotics Anonymous. You know, it seems strange now that during the 90s, you know, I was desperate to get clean in 1992. My daughter was 4 years old and I was desperate. I knew my relationship was crashing. I knew that if I didn't do something about this uncontrollable drug use, you know, the house, the girlfriend and the daughter were gone. And I didn't want that to happen. And I went to all these services, desperate to stop using. And I got hooked up to, you know, electrostimulation therapy, where they're sending voltage through my hands to stop me using. I've had acupuncture, I've drank all funky herbs and medicines, and, you know, and been on methadone, you know, drug replacement therapy. You know, and I sort of look back and reflect on that past experience now, and I think to myself, oh my God, what was I thinking? But I was that desperate, I was prepared to try anything. But I look back now, you know, to give an addict of my type, or say to an addict of my type, they are poor. You want to stop taking drugs? Yeah, desperately. Okay, take this and you don't have to take that. And then they give me heroin. That's like taking a flamethrower off an arsonist, giving them a box of safety matches and asking them not to light fires, you know, because no matter how much drug replacement therapy they gave me, that only addressed the physical uncomfortableness that I felt. It didn't wobble me nuts, and I'm an addict who needs his head wobbling when I take drugs. And I had never figured that out until I got clean in Narcotics Anonymous. And I really started to learn about what I was suffering with. You know, so making that third step decision to turn my will and my life over to a God that I understand was absolutely momentous for me. You know, and it was more than just a decision to turn my will and my life over. It was also a decision to work the rest of the steps in their entirety. You know, I had a really good sponsor and he said, Paul, this is a 12-step program, not a 3-step, 4 or 5-step program. You know, and God bless them people. Because I see a lot of addicts, and, you know, and they come up against like step 4 or whatever step. And, you know, and there's like a little trap my sponsor warned me about. You know, my sponsor called it the newcomer trap. You know, what happens first when we come to Narcotics Anonymous is we're so bankrupt and defeated and feel hopeless and useless that we stop taking drugs, so straight away we'll start to straighten out physically. You know, we start attending meetings, right, and rolling with like-minded, good-meaning people who are doing positive stuff. So we start to straighten out mentally. You know, but here's where the catch comes. You know, slowly but surely, the outside exterior circumstances of our life starts to stand up and correct itself. And what I observe a lot of addicts doing, and I nearly did it myself, is they become so overly involved, exerting and expending all their energy to keep them external circumstances upright. They forget about the internal condition that's chipping away at them, and the ego rebuilds in the background. Bang, they use. And then say, I don't know what happened. Yeah, no shit. You know, this is an internal condition of a spiritual nature. You know, and we've got an internal solution of a spiritual nature that addresses our spiritual deficiency. You know, and that is only accessible through working the 12 steps and going through the work with an informed sponsor. You know, there is no talking cure to this. It's good to talk, don't get me wrong. The therapeutic value of one act is helping another cannot and will not materialise without effective communication. So it's good to talk, but I don't want to sound controversial. I see a lot of meetings and it's like Drama Anonymous sometimes. people talking about childhood issues and mental health issues and relationship issues. You know what I mean? And that's okay, you know what I mean? I just allow these people to learn whatever lessons they need to learn. Because I had to learn a few when affairs come round. You know, I knew that, like, I needed a complete personality change for me to recover my life. And I knew for a fact that going to a few meetings, sitting on the edge, with a bag of popcorn and watching the show weren't going to get me well. I knew that. I had to get involved. You know, my sponsor said there's two types of member. You know, you can either be a participating member who's ready for what we have to offer and you can find this new way of life, or you can be a spectator, what you want to be. You know, and the participating members, the ones who get involved, the ones who work the program, the ones who selflessly give this stuff away, they're the ones who get long-term sustained recovery. That's what I believe. You know what I mean? That's what I observe. You know, when I try and do that myself today, you know what? I love the 12-step program. You know, it's enabled me to build a relationship up with a power greater than myself that I choose to call God. You know, my relationship with God is the most important relationship in my recovery, because unless that is strong, the other relationships in my life become inconsequential. You know what I mean? Because the ego will just kick my ass. I'll just get wrapped up in myself. I'll just become so manipulative and controlling and judgmental. You know, I need to have a conscious contact with God that I understand. You know, and when I'm at one with God and when I'm practicing discipline, prayer and meditation, and I can sort of feel the presence of God's power flowing into my vessel, flowing through me and coming out of me in all my activities, there's no room in me for defects of character. I'm all right. You know what I mean? And whether stuff goes my way or whether it doesn't, I'm not affected by the actions of other people. You know, the actions of other people used to absolutely dominate me in active addiction. You know what I mean? I'm sort of like in a place now in my recovery, because I've been through the 12 steps, I've been through the 12 traditions, I take other addicts through the steps and the traditions, you know, I make myself available, and I am of service, not to everyone, you know, because I've got a real busy life, you know, and I believe that recovery is about balance, you know what I mean? You know, and every hour that I give to another addict, I have to counterbalance that hour, right, to the people I've deprived of my time through active addiction. So every hour I give an addict in my recovery, I have to counterbalance that hour and give an hour to my loved ones. You know what I mean? So it's not possible for me to sponsor loads of people. You know what I mean? I can't help everyone. I do what I can, you know. I believe that diversity in our fellowship is, like, really important. It says in our literature, diversity is our strength. You know, and I say to my sponsors that, like, you know, we have to, you know, nurture and protect our common welfare and foster unity with each other. You know what I mean? You have to allow people to be different to you. You have to allow people to have different ideas to you. Because if you don't allow people to be who they're meant to be, whether they're different ideas or whether they're on a different page or not, I'm not going to experience the full range of like spiritual freedom, if that makes any sense. I love this spiritual way of life. I mean, it's difficult. It is difficult. You know, people, like I said, can have the power to disturb me, but, you know, today I'm sort of, you know, I'm really disciplined around me 10 and 11 disciplines. I truly believe that, like, all I'm responsible for today is Paul and Paul's own personal space. I practice tradition 10 in my own recovery, you know. But other people's recovery is an outside issue. It's none of my business. What they do, who they do it with, where they go to do it, none of my business. It's my business when I'm inside a Narcotics Anonymous arena, you know, and if I see them conducting themselves inappropriately or violating our traditions, you know, I'll speak to the group conscience, you know, and a couple of us will sort of like, you know, quietly intervene in a spiritual way, in a loving way. You know, we're not here to tell people what to do. I'm just here to follow this way, that's it. You know what I mean? But today, I'm only responsible for Paul and Paul's own personal space and what goes on within Paul's own personal space. And most importantly, and this is the important bit, what comes out of Paul's personal space. I have got no control whatsoever over how people see me, how they view me, whether they like me, whether they don't like me, whether they're comfortable with me, or whether they're not comfortable with me. That's none of my business. What is my business is what I put on the table about me to give people to formulate ideas. And that's where my step 10 awareness comes in. I'm not some like spiritual guru who doesn't make any mistakes. I make loads of mistakes. I can do and say loads of dumb stuff and say dumb shit. And I do. I make mistakes, but I've got the humility and the awareness to, you know, when I do something wrong to someone, I walk away and my conscience will not let me get 50 yards away from that situation, because I'll intuitively and automatically be, you know, spot checking what's just happened, you know. And it sounds tough to do, but the longer you do it, it just becomes like automatic, like second nature, you know. And when I've affected someone negatively or I've disturbed someone, my conscience won't let me get further than 50 feet away, you know what I mean? And I'll have to like turn on the ball of my foot, go back and say, you know what, I was really inconsiderate and I weren't very thoughtful about that. I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have made you feel that way. I apologize. I won't let that happen again, you know. And I've got the humility to do that, you know. I'm not perfect, you know. Perfection or trying to seek perfection is an ugly defect, you know, because for me personally, I believe seeking perfection instigates control, and I have to be humble. I mean, I have to recognize my place in the world. I have to recognize how insignificant I am in the grand scheme of things, in relation to this all-encompassing power, right, that generates the spirit of the fellowship. You know, because when two addicts or more come together, we generate this spiritual force that I believe can move mountains. You know what I mean? You know, I know that my active addiction looked like a mountain that couldn't be climbed when I was neck deep in it. You know, through the grace of a loving higher power that I choose to call God, through the support, the generosity and the love of the fellowship and the unity of the fellowship, he carried me up that mountain, you know. And today I'm living the best life possible. I truly believe today that I've become the person that my parents wanted me to be. You know, I made an amends to my father a few years ago. You know, when the last time I saw that man was November 1988, when my mother got put in the ground. You know, caused this guy a lot of grief, a lot of damage. I didn't see him for like nearly 25 years. And I sent him a letter, sent him an indirect amends, a letter. I had to wait over a year for a reply, and then when I got the reply, you know, I was on the phone to this guy, and, you know, and I remember him saying to me, Paul, I just want to say that, like, you know, I'm extremely proud of the man that you've become today. He said, and I just know for a fact that your mother's looking down on it, and she is extremely proud. She went, all we wanted for you is what you've got in your life today. He said, so thank you for allowing me to see this. And it was just such a powerful moment. You know, my daughter's in my life today. You know, when I first come into recovery, I'll wrap this up now. When I first come into recovery, You know, that sentence in step 12 where it says lost dreams awaken. Like I said earlier on, I had all these ideas when I was a young teenager of going to the army or university. Well, obviously because of my criminal activity and my age, I can't go in the army no more because I'm over 50. But, you know, I was encouraged that there was nothing stopping me embarking on a journey to go to university. You know, and as a result of like Narcotics Anonymous, following a few simple suggestions, you know, showing up and doing what gets suggested without question, you know, since I've been in recovery, I've been able to get not one, but 2 degrees. You know, I've just completed a master's in criminal justice. I don't say that out of ego, you know, and the academic journey's not over. If it hadn't been for this lockdown, I'd have been putting in to do a PhD research project. You know, the world is my oyster. You know, with a 12-step program in my life, the possibilities of what I can do and where I can go are limitless. They are endless. You know, as long as I keep coming back, as long as I keep following the suggestions, my life will continue to change in ways I cannot predict or control. You know, I am an extremely grateful, happy customer of Narcotics Anonymous, and I'd encourage anyone who's new about or anyone who's messing about, keep coming back. Just keep coming back. You know what I mean? You know, get involved. You know, I come here with literally nothing in my pocket. A tobacco pouch that I made in a leather shop and a prison card, and I've still got both in my back pocket. And every time I take money or a license out of my card, it's a reminder of what's waiting for me if I stop following this way. You know, I just hope someone has got something from what I've had to say. It's been a pleasure to share my experience. It's been a pleasure to speak on this forum in a relaxed way without feeling under pressure, because 20 minutes is approaching, and you know, for that I'm grateful. You know, I just want to say that I'm just an addict who's caused a lot of damage in his life. He doesn't want to cause any more. And I'm forever grateful for this amazing, amazing fellowship. So, yeah. Thanks again, Steve, for asking me to speak. I'm just an addict. My name's Paul. And I'm just trying to get another day here, like everyone else. And I can't do without you guys. Thanks for allowing me to serve.